Bienvenue à Triad Arts Weekend, mon ami. Je m'appelle David Ford. And today on the show, we're off to New Orleans. First, we'll need some authentic sounds of New Orleans. And for that, we go way back to the early beginnings of jazz. It's a style of music known as Dixieland. And the Muddy River Jazz Band is here to tell it, live in Studio A. Then, writer, journalist, documentary filmmaker, food historian, and New Orleans native Lolis Eric Eli keeps the gumbo train going next. He'll share some of his city's fascinating history and its evolving cuisine post-Katrina, from fabulous pho to tremendous tacos, New Orleans style. He's got a new book, Treme, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans, and he's got recipes to share. And Arts Greensboro's fearless leader, Mr. Tom Fillion, joins me with a sneak preview of 17 Days. Arts Greensboro's got a new look, and we're off to New Orleans next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when I was a youngster, my mom took me to hear legendary jazz clarinetist Benny Goodman live at Carnegie Hall. After the concert, I emptied my piggy bank and went out to purchase my first Benny Goodman album. I found a cheap cutout and actually had some money left over, so when the record store salesman suggested I check out an album by New Orleans Dixieland clarinetist Pete Fountain just a few feet away, I promptly bought that Best of Pete Fountain double album as well. And boy, am I glad I did. When it comes to upbeat, good times music, it's hard to beat a good Dixieland band. And here in the Triad, that means the Muddy River Jazz Band, led by outstanding clarinetist Mr. David Reed. Needless to say, I was thrilled when Dave and his band agreed to come visit us here at the station. They've got a concert coming up on Sunday, September 15th at Fellowship Presbyterian Church, and they stop by WFDD for a little sneak preview live in Studio A. Muddy River Jazz Band, welcome to Studio A. On banjo, Hoxie Jones. On tuba, we've got Tom Reed over there. Drums, John Wilson, way over in the corner, tastefully subdued, but he can cut it when we need it. And Mr. Ken Wilmot on trumpet. Clarinet, reedist, Dave Reed, and Northwestern Wildcat alumnus. Welcome back. Good to see you. It's been a while. Welcome, and Dave, tell me your hook into this great music tradition before we launch into a tune. When did it start, and tell me about it.
Oh, it started real early. I was fourth grade, and my mom was a music teacher, and I think she liked the idea of the clarinet because you could play it in orchestra, you could play it in a jazz band, and you know, she felt it was versatile and so on. So that's what I got started on. This is a school band program.
And this is in Chicago area? Where was this?
Yeah, we were in Highland Park, Illinois at the time. Yeah, just outside of Chicago. Yeah.
Home of Ravinia, Chicago Symphony's summer home, right?
Right.
Highland Park area? Beautiful area. Well, we could talk and talk and talk, but you guys are all warmed up and ready to go. You're itching to itching to dive into a tune here. So, Dave, tell us, what are we going to hear first?
Okay, we're going to do our arrangement of Down by the Riverside. And we kind of picked this because it shows off some of the different instruments at different times, so you can get to hear different ones individually.
Nice. Well, speaking of that, let's launch into it, then we'll follow up with a little sample from each of you, just a little bit, just to kind of put the pieces of the puzzle together. But this is Down by the Riverside and Muddy River Jazz Band live in Studio A. Take it away whenever you're ready. Thank you. Oh, man, that was sweet. What a great way to kick things off. Down by the Riverside, live in Studio A, and this is the Muddy River Jazz Band. Dave, Down by the Riverside, the tune itself, a standard if ever there was one, religious connotations? Is this about a baptism? What's going on down by the Riverside?
Yeah, I think it kind of has a religious connotation. Some of the words in there, like study war no more. We ain't going to study war no more.
I love this tune so much. As you mentioned, we get a chance to kind of break it down. You get to hear the different textures that they build and build and build. And gosh, you guys do a great job of staying out of each other's way and meandering that. But Ken, I'm going to turn to you because you play in the symphony and also some straight ahead jazz. Is there a different approach with Dixieland than, say, straight ahead?
There's a very different approach. Actually, in Dixieland, more or less, the trumpet's role is to play the melody and not stray far from the melody. And I may embellish that here and there, but I can't go too outside of the tune because of my role has to be that melody.
Why is it? What if Ken strays away from that melody, per se? How does that affect what you're doing over there in clarinet?
Well, it might affect it because I'm trying to play into what he's doing. And we're all following the same structure of the tune. So I'll be listening to him and trying to make something fit in with whatever he does. So.
Man, you got a good read today. That sounds really solid. And I don't mean Tom over there on the tube either. I'm talking about that read. That sounds beautiful. Wow, what a sweet sound. Hey, and I'm going to move over to the banjo because for a lot of listeners, hearing a banjo in a jazz setting may be new. In this area, we hear a lot of bluegrass and great bluegrass picking on the banjo, but this is maybe the oldest instrument in this jazz context. Tell me about the role of the banjo. What are you doing over there, Hoaxie? And it sounds so good.
Well, mostly just keeping up with the melody. And accompany, just rhythm, more rhythm than anything else.
So are you keying off of what John's doing over there and trying to find your holes that way, or Tom to your left, the tuba? What are you listening to most?
Yeah, usually I just stay in with Tommy. I rely more on him, and of course I listen with another ear to John over here and try to keep up with all of them because sometimes I get lost.
Well, man, it sounds tight, and I'm really enjoying it. I am a huge fan of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, and man, I'm a big fan of tuba playing. Love your playing here. Is it fun? What do you like about this context? Tell me about your role in the group, Tom, what you love about it.
My musical career started at church in the Moravian music in this area, which is pretty strong, but flourished into invites with the Dixieland that have really helped my career a lot and my playing abilities a lot too. But I'm just a rhythm player. You know, John and I keep the beat. We keep the one and threes going for those guys up there, and that's what sets the tone for the beat.
And when you say the one and threes, you're talking about beat one and beat three.
That's it. We stay on the beats, and we get a chance to shine occasionally, but not much.
Well, that's what I love about that tune. Down by the Riverside, you all got your little four-bar solo or eight-bar solo, as it were. And John, I wouldn't be complete without a visit with John Wilson here. John, you play all styles of music. What's a consideration in this group? What are you thinking? What are some of the things you love about it and you try to get across?
Well, this is the granddaddy of the music of this genre, of the huge genre of jazz and everything that followed. What I'm doing is called a shimmy beat on the snare drum and the bass drum and the hi-hat, and that was first formed by Warren Baby Dodds, the brother of Johnny Dodds, the clarinetist, and they all played with Louis Armstrong back way, way back there. You know, it's just a matter of, like, getting with Tommy and throwing in some syncopation to make it interesting, or else it's just a Sousa march.
Here's a little march beat.
That's an old-fashioned march from, like, the 1800s or before. And this is the shimmy.
It is funky. It's got laid back and tight at the same time. It's a great contrast. Love it. Dave, tell me what we're going to hear next.
We might try a tune called I've Found a New Baby.
I got to ask, I heard a little pitch bending there, and I want to let listeners hear what that is, and then maybe you could describe how the heck you do that, and you do it so well. In that tune, I heard a real nice pitch. Talk about it and give us an example here.
Well, pitch bending is just a way of making things sound a little funkier, like John would say, and you do it with your lip, basically, just by loosening and tightening the lip and making the pitch go flat or go sharp, so...
Right. Now, Ken, the color of this playing, it's like you're right in the moment. You take me back to the 30s. How do you make a trumpet sound cornet-like like that?
There are a couple things that we do in Dixieland music that are not taught in traditional trumpet playing, but one of them I want to demonstrate for you is a lip trill.
I've always wanted to hear a lip trill live in Studio A. What are you doing to make that happen?
You know, actually, it's a movement of the tongue and the lips. And I also do some, it's sort of similar to the bending that Dave did on the clarinet, but it took a lot of practice to do it that fast. But it's sort of a characteristic sound for cornet or trumpet in the Dixieland. Louis Armstrong does quite a bit of that.
Is it a trumpet or a cornet?
This actually is a trumpet that I have with me today, but I do have a cornet.
And just for listeners, what's the difference? The
difference is actually just the design of the instrument. The cornet is what we call conical design. and the trumpet is cylindrical, which means conical, means that the where the mouthpiece goes in the cornet, it starts very small and gradually gets larger, like a cone shape. And actually what that does is gives it a much darker sound. The French horn is also a conical instrument, which gives it that dark sound. And the trumpet is cylindrical, which is pretty much the same diameter of the tubing all the way to the bell, and then it becomes conical at the end. It has a much brighter sound. For some reason, the trumpet became more popular than cornet in classical music and in the big band and jazz music, probably because of its brilliance and bright sound.
That's right. Well, you're getting a beautiful sound regardless, trumpet, cornet, and enjoying it so much. We're going to hear one more tune now, Tin Roof Blues, a classic if ever there was one. Right, the Muddy River Jazz Band. We heard Hoaxie Jones on banjo, and John Wilson on drums, trumpeter Ken Wilmot, Dave Reed on clarinet, and taking a mean tuba solo, Tom Reed. Hey, Tom, I gotta shake your hand on that one. Yeah, that sounded beautiful, man. You deserve your moment in the sun. What do you, I mean? What's your background this time? You said Moravian band is and that's huge here, especially on Easter time. Tell me about your transition to this music and how you kind of grown through it.
Well, I in high school played like everybody, marching bands, and then got out and farmed with my dad for years, and got called by an old friend of mine that played trumpet in a group and asked me to come back and play and see a little bit of Dixieland stuff, and that's where it grew into probably 15, 20 years ago.
I really enjoyed your solo, and thank you for sharing it with us. And hats off to all of you. That was a lot of fun, and I appreciate you being here. Thanks for visiting.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, David.
Thank you so much.
The Muddy River Jazz Band, live in Studio A. You can hear them live in concert on Sunday, September 15th at Fellowship Presbyterian Church. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. When we come back from the short break, you'd better bring your appetite. Journalist, documentary filmmaker, and food historian Lolis Eli may be best known for his work as staff writer for the HBO drama Tremé, set in post-Katrina New Orleans. But his new book, Tremé, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans, is already turning heads of foodies everywhere. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and New Orleans native Lolis Eric Eli is a writer, journalist, documentary filmmaker, and food historian who may be best known for his work as staff writer for the HBO drama set in post-Katrina New Orleans, Tremé. His new book, Tremé, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans, carries the same name, but it stands firmly on its own with a unique mix of New Orleans history and a celebration of the eclectic and inventive culinary spirit that continues to thrive and evolve post-Katrina with 100 heritage and contemporary recipes. Last week, Meridian Restaurant in Winston-Salem put on a Tremé-inspired luncheon menu that people are still buzzing about. Lolis was here to press the flesh and sign copies of his new book. He spoke with me by phone from his home in New Orleans. I want to get into the book and your presence here in Winston-Salem, but what was it like in terms of your takeaway from your experience as road manager for Wynton Marsalis?
Well, by that point, a lot of what Wynton is doing now was being formed. The whole idea of Jazz in Lincoln Center, whole idea of doing more stuff orchestrally and not just small band stuff. And so it was a great experience to learn the music as he was learning it and learning how to expand what he'd been doing previously. Also, it was a great aesthetic education. I mean, even as a writer, the idea of trying to understand how to bring all these different personalities and all this history into the context of one cogent artistic statement was a crucial lesson for me. Plus, I got to travel the world. You know, after a few weeks, our first trip was to South America. My first time going to Argentina and Brazil, countries I still love. Then went over to Europe. And so it was an education for me in a whole lot of ways.
I just got finished watching the 20-minute interview with David Simon and kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of Tremé. And it just seems so deep. There's just such a world there. Maybe the cuisine's not the way to dive into that. But
Well, part of what is interesting about New Orleans is that long before anywhere else in the United States was known for good food, New Orleans had that reputation, even going back to Anthony Trollope in the 1800s. And so there's a long history here, which of course resonates even more now that Americans are discovering American regional cuisine, trying to rediscover the traditions of their ancestors. In New Orleans, we've never lost that. The other thing you find, in fact, this is something I discovered in the course of doing the book, you look at recipes from around the country, and they'll have, for example, New Orleans-style bread pudding, a Creole bread pudding. And the assumption is that these dishes were invented in New Orleans. And in fact, they weren't. They come from England. But New Orleans has put its signature, its stamp on it. And I think the real lesson of New Orleans food is that we need other people in other places need to attempt to find what their traditions are and celebrate them and extend them.
Does someone from New Orleans have to tell that story authentically, or could it be someone from the outside?
The two advantages that people from the outside have. One is that I think New Orleanians often take our culture for granted. And like everyone everywhere else, we think the grass is greener somewhere else. We look at the kind of shiny new things that many of the other great cities of the South have been developing in recent decades, and we say we wish we had that. The other thing that someone from the outside brings is sort of the fervor of the new convert. They are students of this culture in an academic sense, when we New Orleanians assume we know it and therefore don't need to study it. The other thing I'd say about outsiders coming in is that whereas I may go to hear music, live music, you know, once a month or every couple of months, and I may go to a nice restaurant every couple of months, the people who choose to move here are so committed to this culture and so interested in it that I think they probably fuel the ongoing strength of this culture as much, if not in some cases more, than the locals do.
Hmm.
So I think the input of locals in terms of our cuisine and our culture is crucial.
A lot of folks who, and myself included, I guess years ago, not all that familiar with the region, might think, you know, New Orleans, in terms of food, just for example, mm-hmm. okay, we got your gumbo, some spicy sausage, maybe a blackened fish or something. But the variety of the cuisine, it's just really staggering. And it's also growing.
Well, a big part of what has happened in New Orleans cuisine in recent decades is the influence of the Cajun community and the Cajun tradition. Mind you, Cajun country in Louisiana is southwest Louisiana, and depending on exactly where you're going, an hour or two from New Orleans. And this is largely rural food. Mind you, the Cajuns and the Creoles share the same emblematic dishes, the red beans and rice and gumbo and so forth. But the Cajun influence has reinfused some other Louisiana ingredients into New Orleans cuisine. Additionally, what you have is a rich range of contributions from Africa, from Europe, from the Caribbean to create New Orleans cuisine with the new infusion of Asian immigrants from Vietnam mostly and of Latino immigrants largely from Guatemala and Honduras. You have these peoples reinfusing New Orleans cuisine with their influence. So you will often go to a restaurant that is not a Vietnamese restaurant by any stretch and find their version of pho, the Vietnamese soup, or their incorporation of fish sauce or other Vietnamese ingredients. Similarly, tacos are now big in New Orleans. What's interesting to me is that whereas other communities can talk about the ethnic influences in their cuisine and their culture, they're able to differentiate them and say, well, that's the German section, that's the Polish section. In New Orleans, on the plate, it really would be impossible to divide it between which influences came from Africa, which from Europe, which from the Caribbean. For the past couple of hundred years, we've all been cooking together and creating cuisine together.
For me, that's the most beautiful image. And I just see a parallel in the music from Congo Square. There's this mixing of Western classical traditions and I mean the Irish, the English, and then the drumming traditions of Africa and so many mm-hmm. coming together in whatever we call jazz or coming to accept it. In case of the foods, I've been to plenty of restaurants that are fusion restaurants that just seem so forced, like I'm going to do this and this. Could you articulate what sets New Orleans fusion cuisine, for lack of a better way of putting that, apart from those others that are just trying but not quite making the mark?
I think a lot of it has to do with the amount of time that it's taken place. I suspect that if either of us had been alive in 1750, it might not have been so neatly fused. The other thing is that in terms of race in southern Louisiana, it's always been a different prospect. I don't want to minimize the brutality of slavery here during that time, but you always had a more fluid mix of the races of black, white, and mixed race. Even legislatively, it was possible for people to buy their own freedom. And therefore, imagine, for example, what happens when you and your enslaved or you and your free relatives are getting together, sharing all of this kind of food that you both have an influence on. The other thing is that much of what happened in the Northeast is a very class segregation of food culture, and that if you were going to a fancy restaurant, it was either going to be French or Italian. That's never been the case here. There have always been fine Creole restaurants, and even though people always talk about them as being, well, it's French food, all of those places have food that is at least as much Senegalese and Congolese as it is French. And so there's a kind of democracy that takes place on the plate here, whereas in the current context, these chefs are engaging in kind of flights of fancy, dealing with food that their mothers never made and never could have imagined. Sometimes they're very successful at it. I don't want to denigrate that at all. But I think the difference here is that the fusion of our cuisines first took place with the fusions of our peoples a long time ago.
Mm. Tremé, your book has been described as a celebration of the eclectic and inventive culinary spirit of post-Katrina, New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, and I know it depends on where in the city you're talking, whether it's the sliver that somehow survived the storm relatively intact or not, but how would you describe was there a shift, I mean, in terms of the culinary scene in New Orleans pre- and post-Katrina? What are you seeing?
Yeah, and there's several differences. One of the main differences is a recommitment of our fine dining chefs to our food. Mind you, if you're a fancy chef at a white tablecloth restaurant, you're always aware of the possibility of being featured in some major magazine or getting a James Beard Award, et cetera, et cetera. And one way to do that is to try to cook more and more like the people in New York or the people in San Francisco. But at a time right after the federal levee failures, when people were questioning whether or not New Orleans would survive or should survive, each of us had to look within our own genre and figure out a way to express New Orleans, and in so doing, to demonstrate why this place is so crucial. So part of what happened, I remember the first Monday when John Besh reopened Restaurant August, he was serving red beans and rice. Restaurant August is a white tablecloth James Beard Award-winning restaurant. They would not have done that as readily prior to the flood. Additionally, Donald Link was opening Cochon, his restaurant. That's a celebration of Southwest cuisine. So there's that celebration of our traditions. But additionally, we have these influxes of new people. And at first, there was a kind of reluctance to really embrace Latin Americans, in part because they were brought here to do work when New Orleanians were being prevented from coming back and rebuilding our own city. But as the food trucks began to open to serve Latino immigrants, as the taco trucks were opening, New Orleanians began to talk about not only how good they were, but to compare notes on which ones were the best. And I think that has influenced the current food truck movement here. And in terms of food trucks, we're catching up with the rest of the country. But we have to give credit to the Latino immigrants for their influence in terms of that development.
Are you saying this was a natural disaster, pure and simple?
A natural disaster?
Well, a hurricane is.
What hit the Mississippi Gulf Coast was a natural disaster, a hurricane, pure and simple. The flooding of New Orleans was a man-made catastrophe, a federal of epic proportions and decades in the making.
Could you describe just real quickly your role as a story editor for the HBO series Tremé?
For those of us who come from the world of journalism, the use of the word editor in television is sort of laughable. I didn't quote-unquote edit anything, but I was one of the writers who would help shape the stories and write a script each season. But editor referred to a lot of ancillary writing. For example, on the HBO website, we'd have synopses of what's going on with the episodes. We'd also have to write stuff for award competitions, just sort of synopses of what was going on.
Okay.
But when David Simon and Eric Obermeyer came here to do this show, they were both students of New Orleans and qualified in their own right to tell this story. But they also realized that it would be helpful, and in fact it could potentially deepen what they were doing, to have some local writers involved in the writer's room. There were a lot of local consultants who helped to define the music and the food and the Mardi Gras Indian culture, and we certainly got that right. But having me and Tom Piazza, who's also a New Orleans writer, in the room, I think, helped bring an added level of authenticity to a show that set as one of its main goals the authentic expression of the New Orleanian story.
You won an NAACP award for one of the stories you wrote, Santa Claus, Do You Ever Get the Blues? Could you talk about a story or contribution you made to that series that you personally are really proud of?
Well, part of what happened with Tremé is that we were trying not to have it be serialized drama in the cliffhanger sense of the word, where you're waiting until next week to find out the whodunit or to find out, you know, whose baby is this, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But there's something about having those kind of cliffhangers that I think fuels a show and fuels audience interest. So one of the things I suggested in the first season was that LaDonna, the bar owner character whose brother was lost in the storm, I looked at ways in which people got lost in the context of prison after the storm and the prisoners being moved, et cetera, looked at that as a means of having that sort of cliffhanger element. What happened to him? What are the possibilities? And so on one hand, my hope is that you connect with that simply because you're wondering about the solution to this mystery. But on another level, it brings you through one layer of the post-Katrina New Orleans experience, one layer about what happened to people who were caught up in the criminal justice system, often through no fault of their own.
Fire department said it started in the front.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Pour patterns on the floor look like gasoline.
I know who did it. I can't prove it, but I do.
You give him a name?
I don't have a name. Just a face.
Unless someone turns him in or comes forward.
Yeah, that ain't gonna happen. I made lists. Inventory equipment and such.
When was the last time you had an inspection from the city?
Honestly, don't remember. Before Katrina, I guess. I'm not sure.
Last inspection, were you up to code?
No idea.
You cooked in here?
Red beans and rice. Look, a lot of what we had was grandfathered in. Besides, what difference does it make? You can't blame this on faulty wiring or I left the hot plate on.
Miss Williams, we'll be in touch.
Oh, I'm gonna call you, Mr. Cooper.
Yeah, like I said, a few weeks.
I have to ask, what's it like working with David Simon? He seems like a very intense person.
He is very intense. I remember one time I was leaving the office and he was coming in. So we're sort of catty corner outside. And so I said hello to him, and it was clear that he had no idea what was going on. He was, as James Thurber's wife used to say, he was writing, meaning he's walking down the street thinking about what he was going to write, thinking about the show. The important thing to understand about David is that he always has a much larger vision in mind than the basic story that's being told. So when he's talking about what was happening in Baltimore and the drug scene there and the police scene, he's also talking about the way in which urban America was crumbling. Therefore, in the second season, you have the docks. Therefore, you have the school system using statistics in a way that had previously failed with the police department and had been seen subsequently to be failing with the education system. In the context of Tremé, he's again looking at what happens when the federal government abdicates its responsibility to protect and defend its people. And so, in addition to that, he also is looking at American culture and the notion that the food and the music and the architectural artisans in New Orleans were crucial to the rebuilding of the city and point the way to a rebuilding of America. So what's great about David is that he can get into the minutiae. He can get into, well, exactly what was the statistic that we're trying to build this dialogue based on. But he also has a broader vision of attempting to tell the contemporary story of this nation. And so in working with him, it's funny because the writer's room is a very democratic environment. Anybody in the writer's room can put up an idea, and the hope is that the best ideas win and get seconded by everybody else. But as the showrunner, he's ultimately the one who decides which ideas we use and which ones we don't. And what became clear, as a lot of good ideas were put up and dismissed, was that he wasn't looking for a good idea. He had a very specific vision of where he was going with the show. And it became clear that our job in large part was to help him realize that vision.
Yo!
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 Woo! Yeah, 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 yeah.
Woo! Yeah, 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 yeah.
Well, I want to tell you about Oop-Oop-A-Doo. My Oop-Oop-A-Doo. They call me the most.
Can I bring you back to food?
Please.
I like the thought that goes into designing a really compelling menu, and of course the skill that's needed to pull it off. For the non-professional chef, I'm wondering, well, for starters, what needs to go right, say, to pull off oysters on the half shell with yuzu mignonette? What is a yuzu mignonette, and what needs to go right to make that really, you know, fly off the palate?
Well, what you really get is a dialogue between the traditional French mignonette, which is a sort of vinegar-based sauce that you use over raw oysters, plus yuzu, which is an Asian citrus fruit, kind of like a Meyer lemon, but also with its own distinct flavor. Plus, you get the fact that y'all are on the coast of North Carolina, so you get traditional oysters from the area. And so it's a mixing of all of those things, which is, again, the story of contemporary New Orleans cuisine.
I'm familiar with the chicory added to coffee in New Orleans. This is a chicory coffee glazed Manchester Farms quail with chard and a creamy Anselm Mills grits. Now, have you had a chicory coffee glazed dish before? And what can go right? What can go wrong with that combination?
Well, I actually tested that recipe. And in terms of the basic technique of it, it's not a difficult dish because it's not as if you cook it for an extra 30 seconds or 30 seconds too little, it's going to be a major problem. But the great thing about it is the mixing of all these flavors, a mix of things you're familiar with and things you're not familiar with. So certainly you've had grits before, but these grits are incredibly creamy because they're cooked in milk. In terms of the quail, certainly you've had quail, you've had greens of various kinds. But the idea of stuffing the greens into the quail, I think, also gives us this a kind of distinction. And the main thing is just trying to figure out how to get all these things to come together at the same time. The chicory coffee, again, everybody's had coffee. The chicory coffee has a distinctive flavor. We still maintain chicory in our coffee, whereas most of the rest of the country does not do that anymore. You got to figure out how to get the balance right so it doesn't taste so much like coffee as a very rich, dark sauce.
Okay. Well, for someone who's not had lunch yet, I think I better leave it right there. I'm getting
I hope you're coming back to New Orleans. You know it really is that land of dreams. There's no other city like New Orleans.
Writer, journalist, documentary filmmaker, and food historian Lolis Eric Eli. His new book, Tremé, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans, has gotten rave reviews. The man knows New Orleans cuisine. And you can find out where to get your hands on a copy at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take another short break now. When we get back, it's time for 17 Days with Arts Greensboro's Tom Fillion. So much art and culture, so little time. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
Please come home. Orleans, where they still say hello to the music and the culture and all the people that you know. There's just nothing more than New Orleans.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And since its founding in 1962, Greensboro's Arts Council has contributed approximately $20 million to area arts organizations and projects. Today, the Arts Council of Greater Greensboro has a new name, Arts Greensboro, and a new website, artsgreensboro.org. They're continuing to contribute much more than just grants alone to the Triad. Arts Greensboro is currently making final preparations for its 17 Days Arts and Culture Festival. This year's festival runs from September 20th to October 6th, with more than 100 arts events planned. Arts Greensboro President and CEO Tom Fillion dropped by to fill us in on what's new at Arts Greensboro. Tom, what is 17 Days?
Well, 17 Days is a collaborative effort. It's very unique. It's a festival of the arts and culture and entertainment and history and spoken word and music, theater, dance. It's 2.5 weeks of music, theater, dance, and everything else in between. It has, just in 2 years' time, has grown tremendously. We had 75,000 participants last year, last fall.
Wow.
Across 160 events. A lot of them are free. They are all over the city of Greensboro, dozens of venues, mostly indoors, although there are a small number outdoors. And again, because it's across 2.5 weeks and 3 weekends, it gives us an opportunity to touch upon themes within the festival that helps us platform the arts in a way and fuel the marketplace.
And nice timing with a new branding campaign.
Yeah. It allows us to really support the rebranding effort for Arts Greensboro. And the vision for 17 Days was partly made possible in many respects by the support of the media community, the News and Record and Clear Channel Entertainment and public radio stations and you all and printing companies and et cetera. We raised those resources to fuel the arts marketplace in Greensboro, whether it's a play like Wait Until Dark by Triad Stage or whether it's a free event at the library with a storyteller. It just gives us a chance to really platform the arts in ways that we have seen some really remarkable things happen in the last 2 years in terms of attendance and interest.
How does it impact the local business community?
I think it has a tremendous impact because we are putting heads in beds. The numbers from outside Greensboro are growing, and part of the goal of the festival is to create Greensboro as a destination point. Yes, we invoke the word Spoleto. because we think that the infrastructure here in the Triad is wonderful for this kind of activity. And we have so many models here, even within the borders of North Carolina, whether you're talking about Merlefest or some of the other great festivals that have done a wonderful job in drawing visitors to their communities to support the economy.
I never really thought about it in terms of just the concentration of arts within the city itself of Greensboro. You don't have to travel for miles and miles to get from one amazing performance to the next.
No, you can walk down the street, whether you're talking about the Old Broach Theater, which is now owned by the Community Theater, Triad Stage, lots of venues downtown, but there are also many, many venues that we use the festival to help people discover, whether it's wonderful venues over at Greensboro College or A&T University, and just very interesting spaces around town that we use. For example, we're going to do a number of concerts at the Blind Tiger over on Spring Garden Street,
great,
which is a club. But it's a wonderful opportunity for us to mix some metaphors and do some neat stuff and really have some fun with it.
And you mentioned last year 75,000 folks in attendance.
Yep.
This is a first off time. This is a huge project. I mean, how much of your time is invested in just the 17 days?
It's a lot of time. It takes a lot of time. And we have staff really devoted to doing this. And then we bring on people to help us with it and volunteers that help make it happen in the fall. But yes, it's a time consumer. But we believe that it is a very important project because it really platforms Greensboro as an arts community. And it brings interesting events to our community. Whether you talk this year, the schedule is going to include artists like Joan Osborne and Kathy Mattea and Mark Twain tonight with Hal Holbrook. We're going to do, you may know Aoife O'Donovan from Crooked Still. She's going to be doing a date at Triad Stage. Matt Heimovitz is going to be coming into town to do his new version of Beyond Bach, which includes everything from Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock with the national anthem to a Bach cello suite. Very interesting stuff. Wonderful, wonderful things from galleries, so the Wetherspoon Art Museum, Green Hill, to music and dance and theater.
It's a neat mix of national, international artists, and then local groups that, well, you mentioned Triad Stage, a phenomenal world-class theater group, but something like a West End Mambo that may be a first-time treat for listeners.
Yeah, we're going to do a big party over in the Sculpture Garden at the Wetherspoon Art Museum with West End Mambo, and that's going to be one nice party.
And what's up with Joan Osborne? She's here all the time now.
She's doing a lot of great stuff. She's doing, the Grateful Dead thing. She's doing a lot of dates with some interesting artists. Multiple Grammy winner. And, of course, she was nominated this past spring for a Grammy this year. And this date's going to be at Dana Auditorium at Guilford College as part of their homecoming weekend. So it's going to be a very popular event.
Too much for the man. So he's leaving the life.
And you rattled off the name Matt Heimovitz. I mean, he's a popular guy within the classical community, but also, for those who don't know, I mean, a cellist, amazing performer who really prefers these kind of unusual venues and associations.
Yeah. What I think the New York Times called him, the pizza parlor kid or something like that, because he loves to go into unusual venues to perform classical music and other things as well. Lots of interesting collaborations over the years. And when I was in Seattle, he would come once or twice a year and play in a bar called Tractor, and was a line out the door kind of event.
Arts Greensboro President and CEO Tom Fillion. You'll find links to the new Arts Greensboro website at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This year's 17 Days Arts and Culture Festival runs from September 20th to October 6th, with more than 100 arts events planned, from multi-platinum selling recording artist and 7-time Grammy nominee Joan Osborne to Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra trumpet star Brandon Lee. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our superstar intern here at Triad Arts Weekend is Kathleen Coker. Next week, she's moving on to complete her final year of undergraduate work at Converse College, Petrie School of Music in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Kathleen, thank you so much for your outstanding contributions to this program and this station. Your willingness to take on any challenge, your dedication to doing excellent work, and your great sense of humor will be sorely missed. Go get 'em, Tiger. You'll find archived episodes of Triad Arts Weekend and podcasts at WFDD.org. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.